I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CGRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative. Dr. Amit Arya is a Toronto-based doctor specializing in palliative care for long-term care homes with North York General and Kensington Health. He's also an assistant professor at McGill University and a lecturer at the University of Toronto. He joined CGRU to discuss Ontario ending the majority of its mask mandates, the status of the city's long-term care homes, where Toronto stands today amid the pandemic, and the risk of long COVID with the potential for a seventh wave this fall.
Yeah, so my name is Amit Arya, and I am a palliative care physician who works in hospitals, home care, and long-term care homes in the GTA.
Great. And for listeners, can you just tell me briefly about your background in palliative care and working with long-term care homes, please?
Yeah, so I've been working in long-term care homes since 2014, firstly as a part of my comprehensive family medicine practice, and then I retrained in palliative care. And since then, I've been providing specialist palliative care consultations in long-term care. And just for, you know, your listeners to understand, Daniel, what, you know, to give you a brief summary of what I do, a lot of people think of palliative care as end-of-life care, but actually that's not the case. So palliative care is actually not just about the last days or weeks, but in fact, it's about an approach to care which provides relief of suffering. So treatment of, often through treatment of symptoms like pain or nausea or shortness of breath or any other symptoms that somebody might be experiencing, and helping someone to understand their illness, make decisions and plan for the future so that they get treatment which is in line with their wishes and with their stage of illness, along with support for the family. So it's less so about end-of-life care, but more so about providing care to people in a timely fashion when they're living with a life-limiting or incurable illness. And that is actually the case for most people who live in long-term care, where statistics in Ontario tell us that the median prognosis of someone who's admitted to a long-term care facility is 18 months.
You've already commented on the staff and resource shortages of long-term care homes, and we've seen that there's been the effects of the pandemic the last 2 years. And there's a lot of coverage for that in the news. Can you just tell me more about how things are today with long-term care homes? Have there been any changes or not so much?
So if I can be very honest, Daniel, and it makes me pretty sad to speak about this, but, you know, I can't think of any really major improvements that have happened in our long-term care system if we compare to how conditions were before the pandemic. Most definitely, I would say from a COVID-19 perspective, things are much, much better compared to earlier waves where, you know, and that's largely because of improvements in infection control and, of course, the miraculous effect of vaccinations in long-term care, where many residents, if not the majority of residents, have 3 doses and many even have 4 doses at this time. So because of that, we're seeing less outbreaks, less suffering, less deaths from COVID-19. And I can tell you, even at this point in time, at least for the last data that we have from the province, we still have 74 long-term care homes in outbreak and 550 residents with positive infections, but the death rate is significantly lower as compared to before. But in terms of the long-standing issues in long-term care, no pun intended, you know, staffing, accountability, the skill required to care for the residents, I can't really say at this point in time that there have been any significant improvements. And very frankly, that's not just my experience. I regularly speak to people across the province about this issue, and they're also saying the same thing.
I'd also like to know, because it was a recent announcement, but what are your thoughts on the CareTO pilot project with the Lakeshore Lodge?
Yeah, so I think it's great news. And really, the principle behind this is that there's going to be more money allocated to staffing, which really means that care doesn't have to be as regimented and rationed. And that's actually the problem in many long-term care facilities, because they're so understaffed. What it means is that, you know, everybody, for example, gets up at the same time. Everybody has breakfast at the same time. Everybody gets their medications at the same time. And, you know, this sort of analogy of long-term care homes being compared to, I guess, living in army barracks or living in a prison is not too far from the truth because of these conditions. So it should be I mean, we have to strike a balance in our long-term care system between what is a home and what is a medical facility. And we also have to strike a balance between safety and autonomy. And I'm really a full believer that people should be allowed to live their lives as they want. So what that means is that if a resident, for example, wants to sleep in until 10, they want to wake up at, you know, or, you know, at 12, or they want to have ice cream for lunch, they should be allowed to have that. And they should be fully supported in living the life that they want. And that's not the case right now. But of course, part of that is because of understaffing. So if they have more staff, they can provide more personalized and individualized care. And that's what the CareTO program is about, where they're looking to provide that in the municipally funded long-term care facilities, meaning the long-term care homes that are run by the City of Toronto, right? So the issue is, what happens to all the other long-term care residents who don't live in the City of Toronto homes? And that's, you know, definitely a question that we should all be asking.
Well, Dr. Arya is hopeful about Toronto's recent CareTO pilot project to provide higher quality of care. He's reluctant of its expansion, at least for now.
Well, to be very frank with you, right now, this is one of the major problems with our long-term care system is that there's so many disparities in the level of care that people receive. So some long-term care homes are very well funded. These tend to be the not-for-profit or the government-run homes. That is the ones that are run by a municipality. And part of the reason that they're, of course, well-funded is because all of the public taxpayer dollars which go towards these homes are devoted towards care. So 100% of the money that we spend in this sector, as taxpayers in these particular homes, the municipal homes and the not-for-profit homes goes towards care. The not-for-profit homes, some of them are able to fundraise and thereby raise more money for care. The city homes, like City of Toronto homes, and we're just mentioning the CareTO project, they can actually use taxpayer dollars from the municipality and contribute that toward care. So of course, we would expect the care would be higher in general in these homes. And then we have most of the homes in Ontario, which are for-profit. So what that means is that they're run by private corporations whose main interest is unfortunately not in care, but their main interest is in generating profit and running a business. So what that means is that even though they are also funded by us, you know, that like the taxpayer, what it means is that funding which is provided is siphoned away to a third body, towards profit, towards shareholders, towards executive bonuses. And that's obviously a problem because I feel that you should receive the same type of care, regardless of where you are in the system, regardless of your postal code, regardless of which long-term care home you're in. And my last point to this is what many people may not know is that, in fact, you have often not very much choice as a person in the system. If you have a family member in the system or you yourself are waiting for a long-term care home, often there's very little semblance of choice in terms of selecting a particular long-term care home.
Mm-hmm. So I guess right now, getting to the mask mandates, you mentioned also in your tweets of the masks still being mandatory in long-term care homes, and I think it was also announced that it was also going to be in hospitals. In your opinion, is this still enough to protect vulnerable individuals in Toronto and in Ontario?
So, I mean, just to clarify what you said, right now we have a provincial masking requirement in long-term care homes, but we don't have a provincial masking requirement in hospitals. It's not a provincial requirement, but hospitals themselves have gone ahead and said as individual institutions that we are going to continue to require masking. So for example, I work at North York General Hospital, and my hospital right away on the day that the ministry made this announcement, my hospital made their own announcement and said, of course, for the safety of our patients and families and health workers, we're going to continue to require masking. So effectively, even though there's not a provincial requirement for masking, meaning the government is not saying you have to do it, the hospitals themselves have gone ahead and said it. And yes, I think that masking at a bare minimum in healthcare settings will continue to be required for the foreseeable future. And that's because, it's because of the fact that COVID-19 is still here. Dr. Theresa Tam, who is, of course, you know, Canada's chief public health officer, has predicted a seventh wave, as have many other epidemiologists and experts. And, you know, what that means is that we have to be proactive and maintain masks. And I would even argue, ideally, other essential places where people don't have a choice to go or not, where they need to go, should also require masking. And it's really just about the bare minimum, Daniel, where, you know, masking is not something that takes away our freedoms. It's not about lockdowns or capacity restrictions, which we should not ever need. But it's just sort of, honestly, very cheap. Very easy. It's not very disruptive or intrusive, but yet it's still one of the most impactful tools that we have to protect us at this part of the pandemic. And it should still be required. And in my opinion, masking should probably be one of the last public health protections to be dropped in terms of pandemic measures.
He comments on the need for masks in long-term care homes and healthcare facilities. He says masking should be the bare minimum, calling it one of the most fundamental tools at this point of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. You mentioned that Theresa Tam also hinted that there may be a seventh wave in the fall. I'd like to know also your thoughts on that as well, because right now it is the summertime. Everything is opening up. There's no more mask mandate, at least provincially. And a lot of people they're fatigued by COVID and the restrictions. And for, like, in your opinion, what do you think people are missing out on in terms of the virus's continued threat to their health and trusting science in this regard?
So, I mean, Daniel, that's a very complex question, but thanks for asking. You know, I think there's many different angles to what you're saying. So first of all, I mean, one of the first things I think about is that there's been so much misinformation circulating about COVID vaccines and so on, that very frankly, I think many people, including even members of my own family or people that I'm sure we all know, you know, are falling prey to this misinformation. And there's really been no strategy on how to deal with, you know, I guess what is also a pandemic of misinformation at this point in time. And it's really, in some circumstances, even led to deaths unnecessarily with people who were misled about vaccines, for example. So that's something that's still very, very important. In terms of fatigue, I mean, I do understand that, you know, especially with masking, there's a particular trauma that's associated with even seeing someone, you know, in a mask, perhaps, because, you know, maybe the first image that many of us think about when we think about the pandemic is someone wearing a mask, right? When we look at the, you know, newspapers and we look at sort of, you know, what's being reported in the media, we're seeing someone wearing a mask, and that's what we affiliate and that's what we associate in our minds with the pandemic. So that's, I think, where we're hearing of this fatigue and this tiredness about the pandemic. And I think that, I mean, first of all, I'll share my own personal feelings about that. I mean, as a health worker, I can tell you that, you know, me and all health workers, there's no one who's more tired of dealing with COVID-19 or talking about COVID-19 than us. So if anyone wants this to end, it's us. But the reality is that COVID-19 is still something which is having a significant impact for many people. It's still something that is having an impact on our healthcare system. Although the numbers are all trending in the right direction because it's the summer and it's June and it's a seasonal component, but we are all worried about what's going to come up in the fall. And what's paradoxical about, or what's paradoxical about this situation, and I think this is really important to address, is that in fact, you know, providing protections, and I would call them protections, not restrictions, because in my opinion, a mask is not a restriction. It's a protection. And similarly, requiring, or, you know, any requirement to be vaccinated is not a restriction, but it's a protection. But requiring some protections will actually prevent us from heading into situations like January, where we had capacity limits and, you know, sort of so-called lockdowns and so on. That's actually what we need to keep society open. And at the same time, keep society safe for the maximum number of people, along with protecting our healthcare system. And I'm sure if we frame it like that, most people would understand what message we're trying to convey. And I'll repeat it again. We don't need capacity, or we should not need, if we do this properly and proactively, we should not need lockdowns or any type of capacity restrictions ever again. But we need to follow the science. We need to use the tools that we have to keep things open, to protect small businesses, to protect schools, and of course, to protect our healthcare system. And in my mind, that means still masking, It means, you know, wherever possible, obviously restaurants and bars, it's not possible to mask, so that's fine. Requiring vaccination, and more importantly, promoting vaccination, right? If we tell people the wrong message, then obviously they won't want to get vaccinated because they'll think this is not important. So we need to promote it. And thirdly, ventilation. So we need to understand that COVID-19 is an airborne, disease. It spreads like smoke through a room. And that means that, you know, if we sort of have any type of measure to clean the air, improve air filtration, air quality, all of those things will reduce the risk of COVID-19 transmission, which is what we're trying to do at this time.
You've also mentioned how there's that trend going downwards right now, you know, because it is the summer, but we've seen that before the last two summers as well. Is there something different this summer going into what might be a seventh wave this fall? Is there like a difference here?
To be honest, I think the worry is that, you know, at this stage of the pandemic, we have all the tools to actually avoid lockdowns and avoid capacity restrictions and protect people who are most vulnerable, to the impacts of COVID-19. And I'll remind everyone, of course, there are people who are immunocompromised, frail, and elderly who would be more impacted in spite of vaccination. But we all have some baseline risk. Even if we're healthier and younger and fully vaccinated, we have some baseline risk of the most common complication of COVID-19 right now, which is actually not hospitalization or not being in the ICU. It's long COVID. So there's a significant risk of long COVID, and many of our listeners may actually know people in our friends or family members who experienced some of the terrifying symptoms of long COVID, like brain fog, extreme fatigue, shortness of breath. And that's something which is very, very important, where we have to, and it's very important for our governments and people in positions of power and authority to communicate the risk of long COVID, which makes all these measures so much more important.
Further, Dr. Arya says that there is a requirement for a provincial mask mandate. Sending the message that masking is not required can cause more potential problems for vulnerable individuals and healthcare workers, he says.
But I can just sort of, tell you a little bit that, you know, COVID-19 is, of course, still a problem. But we also have to look at really what's happening with our healthcare system. And I can tell you, someone who's working on the front lines of the hospitals, in the home care system, and in long-term care, we're in crisis. So we're severely understaffed in many, many places. I can tell you in my own hospital, from what I hear from my nursing colleagues, nurses are working, 20 to 30% short staffed on a regular basis in terms of shifts, and often worse in places like the emergency departments and ICUs. So we are at a critical staffing shortage, and staffing shortages themselves compromise care. It means that care is either rushed or sometimes it doesn't even happen at all. Because of COVID-19, but also because of rising inequities. So there's more poverty right now, unfortunately, more people who are experiencing homelessness, people who can't afford medications, and also an aging population, a rapidly aging population. We're seeing people who are a lot more sicker, who are in hospitals. And, I think at this point in time, it's absolutely reasonable to just ask for these very, very basic measures, such as continuing to mask, continuing to promote vaccination, because otherwise, it's going to lead to a disaster in our healthcare system. And we're already working through a crisis. Burnout, exhaustion are at record levels at this point in time. So, and I can add that I know right now there's an important conversation going on about airports that you might've seen that was started by, I think, a retired hockey player, Ryan Whitney, who sort of filmed a video of himself and said, this is like the worst place on earth. And he was referring to Toronto Pearson Airport. And I understand that's very frustrating. And, I appreciate we should ask our politicians and people of authority to reduce the waiting times at airports, but please also think about healthcare, that, our healthcare system has terrible waiting times, that you could be, your loved ones might need to access the healthcare system at any time and might be left without enough, without enough nurses to look after you, might be waiting for too long, for hours and hours lying on a stretcher in the emergency department. Of course, we might know people, many, many people who are waiting for months and months for very necessary surgeries and are living with a disability because of that. And it shouldn't have to be that way. So please, we have to really prioritize our healthcare system and rebuild our entire healthcare system at this time.
While COVID-19 remains a worry, He said it should also elucidate the crises and continued strain on Ontario's healthcare system.
So many people have asked me about why a provincial mandate for masking in hospitals still matters as compared to individual hospitals mandating masks on their own. And that's a great question. And I can share with you, the issue is multifactorial, where firstly, I mean, and overall, it's a lot more effective to have the province mandating masks in hospitals in terms of enforcing compliance with the masking requirement, because it carries the force of law behind it and it supports hospitals. And, you know, I can share with you, of course, urban hospitals, which are very big and have lots of legal and administrative support, would likely be able to enforce this without any issues. But I worry about very small and rural hospitals, which don't have that same level of resources, where, I mean, if they encounter a legal challenge, for example, by someone who doesn't understand masking or doesn't believe in it, then, you know, it might really, you know, cause a lot of trouble for those smaller rural hospitals. Secondly, it sends the wrong message. It sends the message that masking is like not required in hospitals, which is absolutely absurd and ridiculous, because hospitals are where people are very sick. That's where we have people who are immunocompromised, frail, older, people who are coming in for cancer treatments, for example. So, I mean, it just doesn't make sense that we would send a message to say that masking is no longer required. And what it means is that for people working on the front lines, especially nurses and people working in administration, for example, they're likely going to face a lot more harassment and verbal abuse from anti-maskers. And that's on top of the current situation where, as I mentioned, Daniel, there's already very, very high rates of exhaustion and burnout, which is leading to understaffing and worsening understaffing. The third thing that I've heard is that, you know, sometimes because there's mixed messages in the media, where on one hand we have the, you know, the government and the, you know, the chief public health officer, Dr. Kieran Moore, saying that, well, we're removing the mask requirement in hospitals. And on the other hand, you know, we're seeing some hospitals saying we're going to continue it. It leads to confusion in the public, where you have maybe vulnerable people or people who are really older who may either, you know, not understand what's going on. They may just listen to the provincial announcement and may actually delay seeking care in a hospital when they actually need it, or maybe not go at all because they might be scared that, oh, there's no masking requirement now, we're not safe. So there's really no upside to this overall decision about, you know, removing masks and, or, you know, removing the provincial requirement for masking in hospitals. And once again, masking is just the bare minimum which should be doing to protect vulnerable patients across the healthcare system.
That was Dr. Amit Arya, specialist in palliative care and long-term care homes. I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CGRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative